Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the Nuts and Bolts of Emotional Reactivity 3.
I had a question about the 5-step mindfulness practice.
Yes.
I'll have a strong reaction to something and decide that I'm going to work with it using that. And as I start, suddenly it's like nothing. It's like, okay, that must not have been a problem. I was just, overreacting. It's not a big deal. But instead of moving away from it, I just stay and do step 1 and 2 a few times, and then pretty much something comes up. But I don't go to 3. I just stay with 1 and 2, and it seems to work, and then I move on to 3. But should I be going through the whole process?
We call it, or it's called 5-step mindfulness practice. And there may be a better word in English rather than step, because step is the idea, okay, I take one step, another step, or climbing a step of stairs. And there's a deliberate, you move from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. This practice doesn't really work that way. It's that the steps evolve out of each other. So the first step is breathing in, I experience this reaction. Breathing out, I experience this reaction, or pain or difficulty or problem. And as you do that, you naturally evolve into the second step, which is breathing in, I experience my reactions to this problem. Breathing out, I experience my reactions to this problem or whatever. And those reactions are at the physical level, how the body's reacting, the emotional level, all the different emotions that are coming up. And at the cognitive level or mental level, which are all the stories and associations and memories and distractions that come up. And you just experience those. And what's happening there is one is moving into a fuller and fuller experience of the problem, the pain, or the reaction, whatever. And in that, you find yourself just experiencing all of that. And now, rather than reacting to all of that, you're just experiencing it, which is actually the start of the third step, which is breathing in, I experience calm in the reaction or in the problem. And that's something that's evolved out of opening to the experience of all of the problem itself and the reactions to it. You follow? So you may find yourself naturally moving into step 3 without actually deciding to. Okay? Now, when you hit step 3, and particularly step 4, as you rest in all of that stuff, breathing in, I experience calm in this reaction. Breathing out, I experience calm in this reaction. Not only that calm gradually evolves into ease or relaxation. So now you're sitting with this problem, and you're actually relaxed. And as soon as we start to relax, then attention opens up, and we experience the problem more deeply. And often that puts us back right back into step 1 again, but now we're operating at a deeper level. So it continues to cycle around this way, and can, over decades, actually. Well, maybe none of you are as screwed up as me, but... but it really can be like that, because you've are able to experience something progressively deeper. And all of this time you think, you know, it's just a mess. But that's the subjective experience, that it's a mess. What is actually happening is one is experiencing more and more completely what's really going on in you. And every time, the more that we're able to experience that, the less we have to react. So we may feel like it's a total mess inside. Other people think, how can you be so calm? Because we're dealing with all the reactions inside rather than spewing them out into the world. You follow? And so through this, then step five isn't something you decide, oh, I understand this now, or I'm going to understand this now. It's something that evolves out of being in that experience. And what happens is that you find a clarity in the experience. And the understanding of the experience, of the reaction, of the problem, arises spontaneously out of the calmness and clarity. And you realize, oh, I was looking at it this way, but now I see it this way. And one's whole relationship with it will have shifted. But none of the steps are something that you decide, I'm going to do this now, I'm going to do this now, I'm going to do this now. It's not those kinds of steps. It's you start off just breathing in, experiencing it, and then you become aware of the physical reactions. You become aware of the emotional reactions. You become aware of the cognitive reactions. Where people get a lot tripped up a lot is that as they sit with a problem, their level of attention is often swept away is good enough by the stories that come up, and so they start spinning the stories. But once you start spinning the stories, you're no longer experiencing the reaction or the problem. You're in the world of the stories. And this is why I consistently emphasize coming to the body and becoming clear about the physical reactions that are arising, because that grounds you in your present experience and you don't spin off in the stories. When you're able to stay in the body and the emotions, then you can experience the stories as stories and not get distracted by them. They're just, you know, stuff that's flying around all over the place. Does this help?
That was very helpful. Can I ask one more question?
Of course.
The step one and two, for me, they seem to just kind of be all in there together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, particularly once you've started to once you're familiar with this practice, yeah, they come very quickly together. So, I mean, you think you really got angry at somebody the other day, say, just as an example.
Good example.
Okay. And you think, oh, I got really angry at that person the other day. And so you recall that and go, and you start feeling the anger. Now, initially, when one's not practicing this, the first thing that's going to happen is, well, he was really a jerk. And and you start off, and those are the stories. But when you're practiced with this, you think, oh, I got really angry. I could feel that grabbing me right here. Okay, and now you're with that sensation, that physical sensation, and then you just progress from there.
Okay. Thank you.
This question was submitted by Vic in Knoxville, Tennessee. My problem is a growing disillusionment and sometimes downright distrust of Tibetan Buddhist practice. Sometimes I question Buddhist principles themselves. I guess my main problem is I have almost no ability to take things on faith. For example, I have problems with the third noble truth. If suffering is subject to arising and cessation, then isn't enlightenment also subject to this? And karma, since it's understandable only to a Buddha, how can I hope to act in a way that stops suffering? I could go on and on, problems with the possibility of future lives and so forth. I've been seriously practicing for 6 years now and have read and studied a significant amount. However, I think my practice has been too cerebral. I wish I could have you force me to analyze all this on the level of feeling and mere knowing, as I hear you do with students on the podcast. My question is, what do I do now?
First, that you've been practicing for 6 years is very good. And from your question, it's very, or from the, what you raise as questions, this is very typical of the kinds of things that we find ourselves, where we have a mixture of traditional perspectives and modern perspectives, and trying to sort the two out is very, very confusing. This is essentially what I'm doing in the Then and Now class, is taking a very traditional set of teachings, the dual ornament of liberation, and trying to sort out exactly this kind of stuff. So let me take a couple of things from what you say. If suffering is subject to arising and cessation, then isn't enlightenment also subject to this? Well, this may seem a little glib, but I think it's a reasonable analogy. A chair occupies space. A chair is subject to impermanence. That is, it's made out of parts and eventually it falls apart. And this chair is no longer. That's like suffering. The space, whether there's a chair there or not, is the same. One of the principles, particularly the Tibetan tradition, is that the awake mind is present and we are confused and unable to recognize it. But it's not a case of the awake mind coming into or going out of being. It's just present. You also say that you have almost no ability to take things on faith. It sounds to me as if you don't have any ability to believe things. You don't take things on belief. And I think that's very good, because it means that you question. Faith, you might think of as the willingness to open to whatever arises in experience. It doesn't involve believing this or believing that, and that things are this way. And so this questioning itself eventually becomes a source of wisdom. But part of this is we need to know how to question in a way that isn't counterproductive, because all of us can tie ourselves up into intellectual knots, particularly on this interface between traditional perspectives and modern perspectives. So if you turn to your next question, karma, since it's understandable only to a Buddha, how can I hope to act in a way that stops suffering? This is a very interesting question. The phrase karma is only understandable to a Buddha, or only a Buddha can see karma, this is a typical expression of a mythic culture, and it's a coded way of saying that karma is a mystery. And what's being referred to here is that the way actions evolve into experience, into lived experience, is a mystery. It's not something that we can see happening, but it is something that we experience. And that's what we mean by mystery here. It's not something we can put into words and give a nice technical explanation or understand conceptually, but we can know it through our own experience. And it's almost as if we can feel it. And when you say, how can I hope to act in a way that stops suffering? That possibility is open to each of us in every moment of our lives. If I can give you a simple example, take a situation you know what the right thing to do is. It's going to cost you something. Maybe it cost you some embarrassment. Maybe it cost you some money. Maybe it cost you your job, or maybe it cost you a friendship. But you know what the right thing to do is. And you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards? Most people, when I ask this question, they say, I don't. And that's right. When we know what the right thing to do is, and we do it, then we don't think about it afterwards. Our mind, our heart, is more at peace. On the other hand, if we know what the right thing to do is in a situation and we don't do it, then it becomes a source of disturbance for us. It becomes a source of suffering. So one way to look at the end of suffering is, how do I live in such a way that I'm not creating turmoil and disturbance in my own mind? And I think you'll quickly see that as you create less and less turmoil and disturbance in your own mind, you'll create less and less disturbance and turmoil in others. And this is how we bring an end to suffering. So that's an example, a couple of examples of ways to approach these things. I would tend to agree with you. You may be thinking too much. So rather than thinking about these questions, I would suggest that when you have a question, don't think about it so much as feel it. Just sit with the question and let it reverberate in your body. All kinds of feelings will come up. Don't try to sort it out. Just let yourself absorb the question, and you may find that a different kind of knowing, a different kind of response comes to that, and that may be helpful to you.
This question was submitted by Caroline in England. I've just finished working through the meditations on death and impermanence, following the structure set out in your book, Wake Up to Your Life. As a result, I've cleared away many of the beliefs that previously set the direction in my life, specifically the need for status and recognition, and the need to progress in a career. This clearing away has left me with a lot more room to maneuver in my life, and has freed me from much of the status anxiety I suffered during my 20s. Yet the process has also left me with very few landmarks by which to steer myself. It's like I have extra power for my journey, but the map has become obscured. I've quit the job I found very dissatisfying and am making efforts to make a living from things that have more meaning. This is difficult because I haven't fully uncovered the values that do hold meaning. So I'm working on a combination of faith and instinct, which I haven't allowed to play much of a role in my life up until now. Undoubtedly, my life is a lot more interesting, yet sometimes the going can be somewhat choppy. I would appreciate any advice you might have on how to work with feelings of disorientation.
Well, Carolyn, that's a little bit of a tall order at 8,000 miles. Working through the meditations on death and impermanence is... That's non-trivial, and as you say, they certainly bring about a different perspective on life. And you make reference to stepping away from what are known as the eight worldly concerns, happiness and unhappiness, gain and loss, fame and obscurity, and respect and disdain. I'd like to suggest that the map isn't so much obscured. I think what you say earlier is a little more accurate. The usual landmarks, the usual reference points, aren't there. So it's like open territory. And now the unfolding of your life is guided by different principles. You are exploring different forms of work. I find this combination of faith and instinct reminds me of a Native American chief called Plenty Coos, who lived in the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century.
during which the Indians were being destroyed as a culture here in America. And he found a way to guide his tribe by trusting that there was a good in the future and feeling his way towards it. In the image of the crow, he was a crow chief, he had to listen like a chickadee. And the commentary on this that I read is that this way of approaching life requires a courage, because you don't know where you're headed, but you can feel that there is something there, a good, which you can work towards. But it also requires a clarity of intention, I would also say a clarity of mind. It's not the clarity of mind tells you where to go, but it allows you to listen and see very, very clearly. And so that information reveals to you possibilities and directions that might not ordinarily be noticed. And it does require courage, because with each step you're stepping into unknown territory. As for working with the feelings of disorientation, these are going to arise quite naturally in this, because as human beings we're used to having the references of either our family life or our social life or our culture and so forth. And when we do these meditations on death and impermanence and really take in deeply the fact that this is our life and our life alone and what are we going to do to it, then all of those other reference points, they may not so much disappear as they diminish in importance. And that's where the feelings of disorientation come from. But I think that through this process, if you sit and let yourself feel all of this, first in the body and then in all of the emotional reactions which arise, you'll begin to discover a clarity of seeing and eventually a clarity of purpose, so that you will actually find a direction. I think one of the things, questions that might be helpful for you is to ask, okay, what do I want from my practice? This is a question we have to ask ourselves repeatedly. Every time we complete a phase of practice or some kind of understanding arises, then we have to ask this question again, and it keeps changing. But it is precisely by asking this question that we can know, we can be clear about our intention in our practice. And when we're clear about our intention, then we can pour our energies into it. And we see how things unfold. Really, life itself is a mystery. We never know what is around the corner. And so there's no possibility of saying everything's going to be all right and it's all going to work out nicely. But if we approach life this way, then we do at least have the possibility of being awake and present for whatever does come to us.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.